streets are screaming now. They brought death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to continue our look at the global economy and the U.S. economy as a follow-up to our discussion last week in which we predicted that the data would show, which it did, that the U.S. First quarter growth pretty much came to a halt, pretty much 0.2%, 0.2%, 0.2% GDP, first quarter GDP. And as we pointed out, this was the fourth such flattening out and or contraction since 2009 in the recovery. So four times in the last 4 years, 5 years, it's collapsed. And that was a preliminary look, of course. So there will be a more detailed GDP figure for the first quarter for the U.S., at the end of this month, May, and we'll get an even better picture. But, you know, the data is beginning to show that it's even weaker than they thought. They, of course, preliminary numbers, they did not have all the detail for March. And March, remember, is not a bad weather month. You know, they kept arguing that, oh, this was bad weather. And as I pointed out, even economists indicate that only one half of 1%, five-tenths is of 1% is attributable to the weather. So, you know, there were other major causes for that first quarter decline in GDP. And we last week identified some of them, and the major one, of course, was the slowing U.S. exports. As the dollar continued to rise in global markets and pretty much taking a whack out of U.S. exports and thus manufacturing. Most of the exports are manufacturing from the U.S. So the manufacturing sector and export sector was the big hit. You know, there were other factors as well that we talked about, like the slowing of the spending on healthcare and et cetera, industrial production, the shale boom coming to an end, and so forth. Predictions are, early predictions by some of the bank research departments are that these revised numbers that will come out at the end of the month will show that the first quarter U.S. GDP actually turned negative by as much as one half of 1%. Instead of, in other words, instead of a two-tenths of 1% growth, it's going to look like a 0.5% decline. So it's much worse, and much worse because of the March figures show an increasing slowing, and some research economists are beginning to say that this weakness could very well, most likely, will spill over into this current second quarter. So the second quarter is not going to be all that robust either. And all this fear about, we might have another slowdown here coming, has prompted the U.S. Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, the chair, to pretty much say, oh, we're going to hold off raising interest rates. You know, there was talk earlier in the year that Fed was going to raise interest rates in June. Well, that's totally off the table. That'll never happen. And then there was speculation, well, maybe next September. I don't believe it's going to happen then either. Because it's going to get weaker. And so this pressure of rising interest rates on U.S. trade exports may abate a little bit, but it's going to be a lag. It's not going to happen all at once, you see, because a lot of contracts are set in an expectation of the dollar rising and so forth. So we're going to see a continuation of that pressure in the second quarter here on U.S. GDP, which derives from the whole trade and thus the rising dollar in relationship to other currencies. And, of course, as the dollar was rising and expectations of Fed raising rates that would cause it to rise more and falling oil prices, which also drive up the dollar, as all that was happening, The Europeans and the Japanese, of course, were driving down their currencies with their massive QE programs, huge amount of government bond buying, and printing money to buy bonds and so forth, pump more, even more money in the economy. And what we have is a kind of competitive devaluation by monetary policy going on worldwide. And you can see it clearly. The U.S. Got an export advantage by driving down the dollar with its QE, and then, of course, the Japanese responded and got a 2013 got a little bit of an advantage at the expense of particularly Europe, which got into an economic funk, and then Europe responded, the Japanese responded again, and now instead of raising interest rates, the U.S. is not going to do that. So what we've got here is this this mess. This economic mess that the central banks have created. Central banks, of course, justified all this massive liquidity injection as a way to bail out the banks. And then they sold us the story that it was necessary to generate economic recovery. Well, all this liquidity simply went into the financial asset markets. You know, pumped up stock markets, particularly U.S. and other stock markets around the world, and drove down interest rates so low that companies just went out and issued bonds and borrowed on their new bonds and used the money to buy back stock and pay dividends. It was so cheap. So it's distorted. The central banks have totally distorted the global market and sent it on in a direction that no one knows where this is really going to eventually lead. And by the way, you know, even the People's Bank of China has been lowering rates and pumping money into its economy as it slows down as well. Repeatedly, every time we get a little slowing in the economy over there, the Central Bank of China, you know, lowers interest rates or pumps money into its economy in different ways. And to keep things going, a little mini-stimulus. And every time it does do that mini-stimulus, it generates speculation in different markets over there. You know, initially it was the property market, residential and commercial property market, and welcoming a flood of foreign hot money into those markets as well, is what China did, as well as pumping it up themselves. And they set off this bubble, this is a couple of years back, of course, bubble in local housing prices and local government investing, because it's the local governments that do a lot of the investing, not only in residential but in industrial production over there. So we had a bubble in local government debt and a bubble in housing and residential and commercial properties. Well, China kind of tried to deflate that bubble, which has had some success in doing so, but all that did was to send the speculative money rushing into Chinese stock markets, which are in a bubble now. You know, bubble, toil and trouble. You know, where's the next bust? And I don't know the last line to rhyme that, but I'm going to think about it. Anyway, you know, we have this speculation going on around the world, and the central banks are feeding it with all the free money, and that's going to continue. And what did we see this past week? Ooh, we saw a strange thing happen in the global bond markets. A lot of volatility, particularly in German bonds, which the German 10-year bond is kind of the benchmark for all the other financial assets in Europe. And all of a sudden, that German bond just spiked up. Nothing, they haven't seen anything like that, you know, anything like that, not just in years, but anything like that. So something's happening over there. And if you read the business press, they have no idea what's going on, why those German bonds spiked up. You know, they're near zero, but all of a sudden, you know, they rose by a tremendous amount, and it caused a shudder throughout all the other financial markets in Europe and globally as well. And we've seen a big bond sell-off going on. Well, does that have something to do with this massive euro European Central Bank's QE policy? Well, they don't really know. It's likely that it does, but they don't know. Or maybe it has something to do with all of a sudden we've got rising oil prices here in the last week or so. You know, price of oil has shot up to $70 a barrel from its low in the 40s. You know, why are we having this volatility in oil prices? You know, there isn't really an increase in demand, and the Saudis keep pumping up the supply. And even in the U.S., the supply, you know, from the oil shale fields has not declined. So, you know, supply keeps going. You know, it should be reducing the price if the supply is rising. The demand has not increased. You know, so why did the oil prices spike up? You know, and is that related to the bond volatility in Europe and elsewhere? Well, they don't have answers for this. But if you look behind, you know, the facade here, you know, usually oil price volatility is driven by speculators. You know, this demand and the supply do not shift that dramatically in the global oil prices, but prices do because speculators jump in and out. Well, who are the big speculators in global oil commodity futures? Who are the big boys pushing that? Well, you know, you got hedge funds and so forth, but guess who? The oil companies themselves. If you look at the last couple months, oil company profits, I'm talking about the Exxons and, you know, BPs and so forth, have surged. How could oil company profits surge when the price of their product is declining? Well, because they're speculating in oil futures. They're trading. And they're making big money trading. Yeah, the oil companies are making most of their profits now from trading, in other words, manipulating the oil price flows up and down. And my guess is they jumped in and they drove the oil price up by speculation, because it's certainly not supply and demand forces here. And, okay, so you drive up oil prices, and, you know, is that somehow connected to global bond prices? And does that have something to do with U.S. interest rates? Well, you betcha. They're all related to each other. All these financial asset markets are you know, closely connected, and one financial asset provokes a movement in another and so forth. And my guess is that's what's going on, but it means that you have more financial instability going on in the global economy. Right? You know, another interesting number, if we look back on in the U.S., returning to the U.S. here, is the job numbers. You know, we talked about GDP, that it's actually going to come in negative when it's revised here, right, and could be significantly negative. Because, you know, even last month, business inventories kind of propped it up, and now there's excess inventory, so that should grow weaker, and the trade continue weak, and all those other factors I talked about last week. So, you know, we're going to have at least a negative half a percentage point drop in U.S. GDP, and it'd be interesting to see how much that spills over into the current second quarter. My guess is the second quarter is not going to be a robust recovery. It's going to be pretty weak, too. It won't be negative, but it'll be pretty weak. So we'll average out the first half of the year probably at less than 1% GDP growth. You know, it's almost stagnation. But let's look at the job numbers, right? The job numbers for last month, we got the new numbers that came out here today. And the new numbers say, okay, last in March it was 126,000 jobs, and now it's 223,000 jobs or something like that. Preliminary numbers again. Well, they revised down the March numbers from 126 to only 85,000 jobs created. Only 85,000 jobs created in March. Now, remember, jobs are a lagging indicator. You know, they come well after the slowdown. So, you know, when we have this first quarter negative GDP that we just had, it takes about 3 or 4 months to get reflected in the job market. So, you know, jobs did not start softening in January, February. They start softening in March, and I'm sure April as well. So that's a significant number that points to a slowing of the economy as well. Averaging over the last 2 months, in other words, barely 150,000. 150,000 is kind of what you need in order to just keep new entrants into the labor force finding jobs. So they're just churning over the jobs. You know, they're not really being able to create jobs for everyone who wants them in the U.S. Another interesting number that just came out is U.S. productivity. You know, and this has something to do with future job creation. U.S. productivity over the last year has been essentially flat. No productivity growth to speak of. And in the last two quarters, it's been negative. Fourth quarter of last year, first quarter of this year. Negative. You know, when productivity is falling, businesses aren't going to add more workers because that will only result in a further drop in productivity and therefore a rise in their unit labor cost. So this productivity flattening out is kind of a canary in the coal mine here that's suggesting that job recovery is going to continue to be weak going forward here. So we'll see what happens with that. But, you know, you got to keep aware of the longer-term trend in productivity. If you look at the U.S., Japan, Europe, in the last decade, it's been a pretty much free fall in productivity gains since, the mid, around 2005-06. At the end of the last boom, it began declining and has pretty much declined steadily ever since. Now, productivity gains and lack of productivity is a reflection of lack of real investment, you know, in the advanced economies like U.S. and so forth, and Europe, Japan, they simply aren't investing in real job creation. You know, I want to read parts here from the Wall Street Journal today. Very interesting. From their editorial page, called The Dealmaker's Economy, Friday, May 8th, 2015. The Dealmaker's Economy. Very interesting article or editorial here. Their conclusions are, of course, totally asked backwards here. I mean, oftentimes the Wall Street Journal uses facts to come to an erroneous conclusion. And I'll indicate what that erroneous conclusion is, but the facts are interesting themselves, right? And what did they say? Well, they're talking about the drop in productivity here that's going on in the first quarter and longer-term trend and so forth, right? Historically slow productivity growth in the current recovery. Again, it's low productivity growth because there's not real investment going on, which has been slowing, right? Quote Wall Street Journal here, quote, money that could go to wealth-creating innovations is instead going to financial deal-making. It's called The Dealmaker's Economy is the title of the piece. Yeah, companies have announced more than $1.3 trillion in mergers and acquisitions so far this year, 23% up. In other words, instead of taking that money and investing and expanding, they use it to buy each other up. That's what M&A deals are about. And the fact that they're so high is a reflection that there's so much money and liquidity out there. And that, of course, is because the Fed and other central banks have been pumping it in for 5 years now. You know, trillions of dollars in QE in the U.S., over $4 trillion in QE. When you add up all the QEs of the world and money injections and various forms of quasi-QE, you know, you got about $9 trillion. The central banks have been pumping into the global economy through QE alone. QE, quantitative easing, means the banks essentially print money or create electronic money, and they go and they buy up these assets and bonds held by private investors. And then, of course, private investors have real liquid assets that are, you know, they're supposed to invest. And in the past decades, many decades ago, they used to invest in real things to make real things, hire real people to make things, but they're not doing that anymore. They're taking all this free money, and they're using it to speculate in even more financial assets. And what are they doing? What are the things they're making? They're engineering financial products. That's what they're making. Financial engineering instead of making real things. And it doesn't take many people to financial engineer products. You know, you just hire some whiz kids from Wharton, and they put them to work in a cube and dream up a new asset, a new derivative, or something like that. You know, around the world, the era of easy money, right, and slow growth. Now, why take a chance trying to create a new product, unquote, when you can buy an existing one? In other words, mergers, acquisitions, $1.3 trillion globally. You know, that's a small part of the roughly, I estimate, $25 trillion in liquidity that's been generated here since the crisis, the end of the crisis, 5 years, 6 years ago. When you add up QE, it's about $9 trillion for all the major central banks. But then there's all this zero interest rate stuff and, auctions, special auctions where even more money is pumped in. That's generated, at least another $10, $15 trillion. So it's about $25 trillion, I estimate, liquidity, new liquidity pumped into the economy. Far more liquidity than can't even be invested in real things. Apart from the fact they don't want to invest in real things anymore, they want to create new financial products and invest in those and engage in mergers and acquisitions, or they just sit on the trillions of dollars, or they pay it back to their shareholders in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. You know, last week we talked about how in the U.S. alone, the S&P 500 largest corporations have, since 2009, have bought back stock and paid out dividends to the tune of $5 trillion. $5 trillion, yes. Which is just about the additional net increase in profits. Of course, it's not that they turned around all the profits, because they went out and they raised money by issuing bonds, and some of that's used to buy back the stock and pay out dividends too, and the rest, of course, sitting on their balance sheets. And by the way, when I say $5 trillion in buybacks so far, I'm not even counting private equity firms and hedge firms that pay out every year to their shareholders, hundreds of billions of dollars. So, and then you got to realize that's why you got income inequality, folks. You know, income inequality is not just holding down wages of regular folks, which, of course, is part of it, big part of it. It's also pumping up the capital incomes of the rich, and the best and fastest and biggest way to pump up those capital incomes is through financial speculation. And then you keep the dividend taxes and capital gains taxes low, so it all goes out there to these wealthiest 1%. But, you won't hear anybody talking about that and writing about that. Even Paul Krugman, New York Times, that income equality is as much due to financial asset booms and bubbles and profits from financial asset investing as it is from squeezing wages on workers. It's both. It's both. Okay, so continuing with this Wall Street Journal article here, a recent survey from the National Federation of Independent Businesses shows that business owners aren't borrowing because they don't know what to do with the money. Okay. Kauffman Foundation, which tracks new business, shows 2013 was the second consecutive year to show an entrepreneurial activity declined in the U.S. So, initial business formation and creating things and real services and real goods and so forth is falling off, right? What are companies doing with all the money they raise? Not necessarily funding future prosperity, is the quote here. Money flowing, this is a quote from the Wall Street Journal, money flowing into companies in recent years was directed to financial rather than economic risk-taking. The dollar volume of stock buybacks has soared 287% since the post-crisis low, and the value of mergers and acquisitions was up 179%. Well, that's where all the money is going. All the free money the Fed has created, right? And what about capital expenditures that support business expansion? In other words, real investment. Okay, they shrank in the first quarter by 3.4%, according to the Commerce Department. Right, net private non-residential fixed investment is now the lowest since the mid-1990s, the lowest in 20 years. During the first 5 years of the Obama administration. Okay, so all these facts are correct. They show where all this money is going into financial engineering and speculation, and at the same time, it is not going into real asset creation that would create jobs, making things, etc. Where that's declining. So the profits are rising and accelerating from financial assets, and also, you know, from squeezing labor and costs. And in real investment is declining. Now, of course, the Wall Street Journal takes reality and it gives it an unreal twist when it says, oh, the reason for all this is because of too much regulation. Yeah, of course, you know, that's one of their mantras there, too much regulation. And that and Obama's ACA are their bête noire issues. So, but the facts are true. Their conclusions are wrong, but the facts are true here. And it's creating all these asset bubbles. And in fact, Janet Yellen, chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve, this past week, sort of warned against U.S. stock bubbles. And whoa, you know, that caused a stir. You let that one slip, Janet. Watch out. They're going to replace you with Vice Chairman Fisher here pretty soon if you make another faux pas here. You're not supposed to say those things, right? Because that causes the bubble in the stock market to retreat. Oh, well, it retreats, and you know, then it bounces back up. If you look at U.S. stocks, the Dow, you know, it's been floating between 18,000, 17,000, back and forth, back and forth. Whenever it tries to correct, as a normal market would, because it's in a bubble range right now, just as all the global stock markets, you know, these in China and U.S. and other places are in bubble territory. When it tries to retreat, all this money's on the sideline. You know, all the shadow banks, institutionals, they got all this money, and they jump back into the market when it, you know, retreats 500, 600, you know, and they drive it back up and make another short-term profit out of it all. And then they wait for it to correct again, and they drive it back up. And it's been fluctuating, bouncing between 17,000 and 18,000 now for, what, 2 years almost? In other words, the financial market, even the stock market, is totally distorted because there's so much money on the sideline, and it jumps in periodically whenever there's an opportunity to make some, you know? And then you look at China, you know, it's got a stock market bubble. It had a bubble in its property markets, which it has diffused some. Prices are coming down. Local government debt market, another bubble that they're trying to get their hands around. Industrial corporations offering derivatives to keep going. That's a financial instability a sector there. Asset management speculation, you know, rich folks who got rich in China, you know, what are they going to do with their money? They got to put it somewhere, you know, and they can't put it in real estate anymore because that's been sort of walled off a bit by the government, so it's going into this asset market speculation, right? Our currency speculation, so forth. So we got all these bubbles, you know, kind of like whack-a-mole, you know, that game whack-a-mole. It comes a bubble, they whack it, and there comes another bubble, they whack it, because the money just keeps moving around. It's a different financial markets over there. And China keeps trying to generate economic growth as their real growth slows by these mini monetary stimulus. You know, People's Bank of China and others, you know, let's pump a little bit more money in, And they're like dribbling, dribbling the excess liquidity into their economy, whereas Europe and Japan, you know, open the floodgates and let it surge in. But long run, the outcome is pretty much the same thing. Okay. Well, let's watch this corporate bond market and sovereign and corporate bond market globally, because it's beginning to show signs of another flash crash like last year, becoming unstable. We'll continue to watch what's going on with the stock and bond markets in the U.S. And in China as well. But they're all frothing at the peak here, right? And a lot of volatility is coming here in all these financial markets very, very soon. I want to use this discussion as an opportunity to introduce my listeners here to my new forthcoming book, which is coming out in September, published by Clarity Press, and it's called Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. Okay, systemic fragility. In other words, the system itself is becoming fragile. Well, what do we mean by fragility? Fragility leads to instability and bubbles and crashes, right? And fragility is really a function, a cause of two or three different main variables. One is rising debt. You see, with all this liquidity, it's easy to borrow at very low cost. So people, investors, borrow money on top of the money they have, and that fuels these financial asset price bubbles everywhere. Okay. Ultimately, all the, you know, the money that is possible to borrow comes from this central banks pumping all this money into the economy, which has been going on increasingly. But it's really been a product of several decades, you know, ever since the 1970s, when the U.S. and the global economy went off of the what's called the Bretton Woods dollar gold standard. And left it up to the central banks to maintain stability between their respective currencies, left it up to central banks buy and sell money, inject money to maintain this global stability. Ever since then, central banks, and increasingly so, have been losing control of the injections. You know, whenever there's a recession, they pump money in. Whenever there's a bank crash, they bail them out. So we've got this constant liquidity injection, money injection going on by central banks, not just the U.S., right? And that huge amount of liquidity just begins to feed these bubbles, financial bubbles, more and more. And financial speculation, more risky but more profitable than real asset investment. So professional investors, you know, who aren't tied to any given company and, you know, attempt to grow the company and so forth, just want to make quick profits from asset price appreciation. And there's more and more of them globally, and they have more assets than ever before. You know, their institutional framework is what we call the shadow banks, the private equity firms and, you know, hedge funds and boutique banks and asset management funds and so forth. You know, this is the nature of 21st century finance capital, and it's becoming a dominant characteristic. You know, the origins of this is in the breakup of the international monetary system in the 70s, and then in the 1980s, what they did was eliminate controls on capital, money capital flows globally. U.S. took the lead in that under Reagan, and all the other countries quickly followed because the financial institutions love that, you know. No controls on capital flows. And then we get the technology and the Internet created in the 90s, which allow you know, the movement of this money capital instantaneously around the globe to jump into this or that financial market and jump out just as quickly and do it in fast trading and so forth. So we have faster flows, ever faster flows and larger flows, and more liquidity feeding the flows. And all this, you know, feeds financial speculation. And it becomes, as long as all of these things continue, right, faster and faster technology, more and more liquidity, and further and further deregulation and capital flows, as long as these factors continue, it keeps driving up financial asset prices, which become very profitable to engage in. You can make profits much quicker by financial speculation than you can in trying to create a product in which you've got to get suppliers and materials, and you've got to hire human beings, and you've got to, you know, get your costs down, and, you know, you have a cost of goods with all that, and you have, when you eventually sell it, you need a distribution network to sell it, and so forth. You've got to hire salespeople, et cetera. Much more costly, slower. Financial asset speculation has none of those restrictions. You know, it doesn't cost anything to make engineer these financial products, one. Two, you don't need a sales force to speak of. It's all done on the Internet electronically. Right? People come to you to see what you have to offer, you know, professional investors and so forth. You know, you don't need a sales force. You don't have to spend money on goods to, you know, intermediate goods and hiring people to make things and so forth, and you can turn this stuff over faster, you know. And if everyone's jumping into it, there goes the prices and becomes profitable, super profitable. That's a characteristic of 21st century capitalism that most folks aren't aware of in the economics profession. You know, they're not trained to look at financial variables. Mainstream economists, they're not interested in that because they're not trained in that. They're trained in looking at the Commerce Department, national income, product accounts, real variables rather than financial variables. In fact, financial variables are excluded from the NIPA, national product accounts, national income product accounts, GDP analysis, whatever. So they don't really understand finance. And on the other side, you have the financial professors who don't understand economics, you know, who believe all this nonsense about free markets are efficient and correct themselves and all that other HS, right? I won't say it here. Horse H, right? Okay. So you get the academics and the professors and so forth. They don't know what the hell's going on, most of them. Now, there's a few exceptions. But anyway, that's the main characteristic. And in my book, Systemic Fragility in Global Economy, that's really what I focus on, you know. Let me tell you a few things about the book here. And let me start with a point that I make, and that is the global recovery after 2009 was very mixed. First of all, it was very, very slow in the advanced economies. All this massive injection of liquidity by the central banks of the advanced economies, you know, U.S., Europe, U.K., Japan, right? All this massive liquidity in a global economy with global financial system linked technologically with no limits on capital controls, all that liquidity by the central banks simply flowed out of the U.S. In 2010-11, and it went largely to emerging markets because that's where the greater profitability was. And it went into financial markets around the world as well. You know, China was a big benefactor of a lot of that. And China invested and boosted its economy with a big fiscal stimulus, investment stimulus, government spending stimulus, and all this foreign capital flow together with that caused a big boom in China's economy. You know, GDP growing 10, 12, 14% for a couple of years there. And that pulled up all the emerging markets as well, who were selling commodities and materials to China. you know, Australia, Brazil, and so on and so forth. And as their real economies rose, the opportunities for investing in their stock and bond markets were significant as well. So a lot of the money of the Western vast economies investors flowed into these emerging markets for a couple of years. But starting around 2012, 2013, right, the money stopped flowing in as large a magnitude as it had, because the economies in Europe and so forth, in Japan, kept having recessions time and time again, multiple recessions. And as I said, the U.S. kept having these relapses, you know. Relapses are, unlike bona fide recessions, at least one quarter of negative GDP growth. And we've had several of those in the U.S. and normal economic growth of half of what is typical from a recession. But around 2013, the Federal Reserve of the U.S. said, okay, we're gonna reduce our QE, bring it to an end, and we're going to raise rates. And once that happened, the money that had flowed to China and emerging markets started flowing back. And it's continuing to flow back. You know, something like $2.5 trillion that flowed out to emerging markets now is flowing back. And this year, the expectation is going to be about $600 billion flow back here of that $2.2 trillion. And that means that capital flight out of emerging markets is occurring, and including China. Hot money's flowing back. And then that's why China has to keep pumping more liquidity itself from its own central bank, because this money is flowing back. Of course, emerging markets are getting hit with a double whammy, because now China's growth is slowing and the demand by China for their commodities, you know, Australia and Brazil and others in particular, is declining. At the same time, the money capital is flowing back to Europe and the U.S., you know, their currencies are collapsing. They have to raise their interest rates to try to keep the money from flowing out too fast. That slows down their economy, and then they have collapsing oil prices and export sales. So all of that combined slows down emerging markets now, where the real stress is. In other words, the U.S. has exported its slowdown to some extent to emerging markets, because it can do that. You know, it drives global central banks, and the currency, global currency, is the U.S. dollar. Okay, so that's sort of the scenario in the last 2 years where we've been, and the Fed has backed off a little, you know, time and time again from moving too quickly in this direction because of the disruptions elsewhere in the world, which disruptions mean offshore U.S. multinational corporations are going to take a hit in their profits, which, of course, they have already with the rising dollar, which is due to threats to raise interest rates by the Federal Reserve. Okay, so the book does is look at this these shifts going on, and says that that little recovery in 2010 to 2012, which occurred mostly in emerging markets, was really the dead cat bounce recovery, as I call it. You know, dead cat bounce, right? That's a phrase that means, the cat's about to die, but he comes to life at the last minute. You know, he bounces up, you know, and then he runs around in a circle and then he flops, right? That's a dead cat bounce. Well, let me just read this passage, right? The dead cat bounce and its bounce metaphor may describe the performance of the global economy during 2011-13, following the crash of 2008-09. I'm quoting from the chapter in the book here. The 2011 global recovery, driven largely by China and emerging markets commodities train pulled along by the China engine, may prove in retrospect a kind of economic dead cat bounce. The cat that crashed in 2008-09, that bounced up in 2011-13, and then ran around in emerging markets and advanced economies' speculative bubbles, appears by 2015 today to have become somewhat dizzy and exhausted. It may soon flop again, roll over on its back and require more than a resuscitation of central bank liquidity and an intravenous shot at business tax cuts and corporate bailouts to get it back on its feet. Whether the bouncing cat is approaching the end of its nine lives is the question of the day. This book looks at these nine lives of the dead cat, or almost dead cat, right? What are they? What does the book look at specifically? Well, first of all, documents by various global reports, the fact that the real investment, in other words, investment in plant and equipment and structures and so forth that we call, you know, real investment, as opposed to financial asset investment, two kinds of investment, right? It looks at real investment, all these studies and, you know, by Bank of International Settlements and so forth, showing that real investment globally is slowing down, has been steadily. It's secular, it's structural. It's been going on here for at least, you know, one and a half, maybe two decades. It then looks at another of the key trends. The second key trend is deflation in goods and services. There's a drift towards deflation in all these advanced economies. Different rates, right? Some of them aren't deflated in deflation territory yet, but they are experiencing, you know, definite disinflation. In other words, the rate of growth in inflation is declining, slowing. And we're approaching deflation. Well, the two are linked. You know, the slowing real investment has a big impact on the deflation in goods and services, things. On the other hand, financial assets are not deflating. They are inflating significantly, rapidly to record levels. So we have this anomaly of financial asset excess inflation bubbles. At the same time, we have real goods and services price deflation and disinflation going on. Well, that's linked to the fact that we have a declining real investment going on globally, the two. And the converse of this is, of course, not just financial asset inflation, but financial asset investment acceleration. In other words, things are counterposed here. Slowing real investment, accelerating financial asset investment. Slowing prices of goods and services, accelerating financial asset prices and so forth. Okay? So something's happening here in the relationship. And you can't understand what's happening unless you look at investment and the price systems in this dual manner, is what I'm saying, which is what economists don't do. By dual manner, I mean you have to distinguish between the drivers and causes of real asset investment and the drivers and causes of financial asset investment. And how are the two related to each other? At the same time, you have to distinguish between the fact that there's two price systems. One, prices behave a certain way for financial securities, and prices behave differently for goods and services. By the way, this two-price theory idea is not original on my part, you know. Others have talked about it in the past, Minsky and, of course, Keynes even. But their ideas have been expunged from contemporary economic analysis. The third major trend is this explosion in money and liquidity being driven by the central banks ever since the Bretton Woods system collapsed. Okay, and controls on capital flows across countries have been eliminated, and technology has accelerated it all, right? Explosion of liquidity, which means fourth trend, rise in global debt is a consequence of that. And if you look at you know, recent report by Bank of International Settlements, where is this huge increase in global debt coming from? Well, it's coming from the private sector. You know, we tend to think, oh, it's the government, sovereign debt, you know, that's out of control. No, no. Sovereign debt rises and is a problem because the governments try to bail out the crises and, in essence, take the debt from corporations and banks and put it on its own balance sheets, government balance sheets. So a global debt on the government side is the consequence of the rising, accelerating debt on the private sector, particularly corporate business debt, including bank debt, but corporate business debt, you know, not so much on the private side, the consumer debt, but more, although that's been rising steadily as people's incomes aren't rising and they got to make up some way to maintain their standard of living, so they borrow more. You know, that's a big conspiracy, too. That's a way of holding down, given an average folks' wage increases. You just give them more credit, which means credit. What is that? That's a claim on your future wages, right? We're going to let you buy now in credit, and then we're going to take it out of your future wages. It's a way of secondary exploitation. I'm going to exploit you now by paying you less or making you work harder and not getting any more. Right, take away your benefits and all that stuff, right? And then I'm going to keep that and give it to my shareholders. Right? That's one way of exploiting, intensifying the exploitation, which is going on intensely everywhere in advanced countries and economies. Folks who got a job know they're working like hell and harder just to keep it. And folks who don't got one are scurrying around, you know, trying to find one, and all they can get is a part-time one. With no benefits. And that's the reality of what's going on here in the U.S. and in Europe and in Japan. They're hiring all part-time temp contingent people everywhere, so they don't have to pay benefits, so they can get rid of you whenever they want, and they don't have to pay as much. Right? What, 50, 60, 70% of all the new hires in Europe are contingent, you know. Same thing in the U.S. They grossly underestimate the number of people who are part-time temp and contractors and so forth being hired. In Japan, the same thing. They're doing the same thing everywhere to hold down wage costs. They're very successful in it. So then they got, you know, people aren't making enough money. They got to let you have access to credit so you can at least buy crap in order to struggle maintain your standard of living. You know, that's the wheel, you know, all of us hamsters are on right now, including yours truly, right? So global debt is a consequence of this massive liquidity. If the money's there, they're going to borrow it, right? The whole idea of speculative finance is to use other people's money. You know, put up a dollar of your own, borrow nine, go buy a financial security. When the price spikes, you know, because all you and all your finance capital elite globally are doing the same thing. When it spikes, then dump the stuff, go on to another bubble. You know, and make huge money that way. That's where all the money's being made. Money's profits are being made two ways. You know, in the U.S., $5 trillion, just the S&P 500 since 2010, net increase over 2007 profit levels, $5 trillion. You know, you make it two ways. One, you squeeze your labor force and your cost out, that's called profit margin expansion, right? And you make profits that way. You don't make profits by selling more stuff or at a higher price because prices are weakening, right? So you make stuff by squeezing costs, you know, or you make huge profits by taking that initial profits and investing it in financial assets. So profits are rising, accelerating. Oh, here's the figure for you, okay? The Standard & Poor's 2014 report shows non-financial corporations' profits. Okay, this is the same group whose real investment has been steadily declining. Right, those profits rose 16-17% between every year annually between 2004 and 7. In other words, in 4 years before the crisis. Right, they're growing nicely, 16-17% every year. S&P 500. Okay. Their profits continued to rise 16-17% right through the 2008-09 crash. And then from 2010 to 13, guess what? They continued to rise at an annual rate of 15-17%. In other words, these big multinational corporations just blew right through this crisis in terms of profits. Yeah. It didn't even exist for them. And where are these profits coming from for them? Well, they're not coming necessarily from making things and selling more things. They're coming from squeezing their workforce and speculating in financial asset markets. That's where it's going. And part of the thesis in my book is that this constitutes a shift going on in financial asset investing, because it's so much more profitable and less risky in some ways, right? A shift of money capital is going into more and more financial asset investing, and it is being squeezed out of investing in real assets, right? It's crowding out real investment. The opportunities for super profits are crowding out real investment. And, businesses are making money on the real profits on the real investment side, not by investing, but by squeezing wages and costs. That's what's going on. That's why profits are just continuing to rise, and, they double what they were on 79, 50% of what they were in 2009. Although it's 279% in financial asset increases, right? And in mergers and acquisitions, whatever you want to call them, right? Again, the figures from this Wall Street Journal piece here. Very interesting. Very interesting. 287% stock buybacks soar by, and mergers and acquisitions, 179% increase since 2010. Almost a doubling of profits, A tripling almost of the Dow Jones stock market in the U.S., a doubling of junk bond returns and so forth. Well, this is all financial profits, financial speculation. It's so profitable that the money is flowing out of investing in real things, and what they're doing instead is just squeezing costs, investing real things, and flowing into financial speculation. And that's why profits are just, aggregate profits are just keep rising. And with it, of course, since they're financial profits and the tax rates are much lower for capital gains and dividends, the rich just keep the money. They're able to keep the money. And that's why income inequality is accelerating. It's accelerating because more of it's going to the top while they're holding down wages for the rest. So this is like a double whammy effect on income inequality, right? And all this fiscal and monetary policy, is not working anymore. Well, anyway, the fifth trend is the speculative financial investing shift. And the sixth trend I talk about is restructuring of financial asset markets globally to enhance capital incomes. And another trend, seventh trend, is restructuring of labor markets globally in order to reduce wage incomes. We got a major change in global capitalism on both the financial side and the labor market side in the 21st century. And for these reasons and this growing fragility, that's the consequence. The eighth trend is that central bank monetary policy is proving a failure as far as generating, stimulating the real economy. It's a success stimulating the financial asset economy. But real economy, you're not getting much bang for that buck. And then government fiscal policy is a failure again. Business tax cuts aren't stimulating real investment. And in many places, it's austerity. Right? And to the extent that you may have some minimal government spending, it's not going spending to really create real jobs and real investment. So we got these nine trends that are very key, and my book looks at those nine trends and says if you understand the relationship between real investment and financial investment and the speculative shift and how it's related to deflation and inflation and the credit and money explosion and the restructuring of financial and labor markets, you can explain why we have this financial instability today that is getting worse under the surface. And we're going to see more of these eruptions on instability in financial and real markets going forward. Okay, in future shows, I'll talk more about other chapters in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, Clarity Press, this summer, 2015. And next week, we'll continue. A tale of two exits. Is Britain going to exit the EU? Is Greece going to exit The Eurozone? Okay, we'll talk about that next week. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.